Welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to On the Case, LSE Law Society's new podcast. This is our inaugural episode, and we're delighted to have Professor David Kershaw, Dean of LSE Law School, with us today. Professor Kershaw is also the General Editor of the Modern Law Review, an Associate Tenant at Cornerstone Barristers, and a Senior Researcher with LSE's Financial Markets Group. Prior to joining the LSE, he was a lecturer in law at the University of Warwick. Before his academic career, he was admitted to the New York Bar and is a qualified UK solicitor. He qualified as a UK solicitor at Herbert Smith in London and practiced corporate law in the Mergers and Acquisitions Group of Sherman and Sterling in New York and London. He holds an LLM and an SJD from Harvard Law School and a Bachelor of Laws from the University of Warwick. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thanks very much, Andrew. It's wonderful to be here and just absolutely fantastic that you're doing this podcast. I'm so delighted.
This episode will be a discussion on, you know, your journey into law and your professional career as a corporate lawyer and an academic. Let's talk a bit about your LLB at Warwick and your LLM at Harvard first. So what were you like as a law student? Did you keep up to date with all your readings?
what am I supposed to say? I've got to say yes, right? So, I mean, Warwick was a pretty special place to study law, I have to say. And again, in many ways, there was a big difference then between Warwick and a lot of other universities, and a difference that's disappeared, I think, to a large extent. So Warwick was a sort of the home of what we call today law in context in the UK. So thinking about the study of law in the context in which it's produced and the context in which it's applied. And that's why I went there, because that just seemed like really, really interesting to me. Thinking about law as a social science, which is, of course, what we do now today at the LSE 100%, right? It's all about context. But Warwick was a leader in that regard then. So, you know, this was an amazing place to study, and it was very exciting. But what was I like as a law student? Not initially a particularly good one. It did take me a long time to have the confidence, I think, in the classroom. I was very young when I went there, very young in my year. So when I turned up to university, I'd just turned 18. I was quite immature, quite scared, quite frightened, frankly. You know, you're a first year LLB, Andrew, right? I mean,
young, dumb and broke.
Young, dumb and broke. Well, you're young. You're definitely not dumb, and I don't know whether you're broke. But maybe I was all three of those. And yes, scared to death, frankly. I remember, you know, for a long time, actually, those seminar rooms in which you wanted to say something, you had an idea about something, but you just felt so overwhelmingly intimidated by everyone around you. You know, your heart's racing because, you know, you don't know whether what you've got to say is worthwhile or interesting or stupid. And I really struggled with that for quite a while. And then it was in my third year, and a couple of amazing teachers, a chap called Professor Julio Fondes, who taught me international law, Colin Scott and Imelda Meyer, who are now at UCD, were my teachers then. Another chap called Graham Moffat and Joe McCarry. Just inspirational teachers in this year. And slowly but surely, I learned to engage and to talk. And the more I engaged, the more I taught, the more I loved it. It was a phenomenal year. And a phenomenal year because I also, I've always said this to my students, and they all say, oh, come on, David, that's, you know, you're just saying that. You know, talking to each other, right? So I lived with a couple of guys on my course. Richard Moorhead is one, who's now one of the leading sociology of the law profession people in the UK. Another chap called Matt Cowie, who's not an academic. And we had a good time, we had a good laugh, we drank a lot of beers, but we also sat around doing a lot of talking about the work that we had to do and working out together what we thought about the problems that we'd been discussing in class. And that was just magnificent for learning. I mean, I learned a lot from my teachers, but I think I learned just as much from Richard and Matt in that year. And so, that was my journey to just being, you know, excited about law was that final year.
I think that's the beauty of university, which is that you're not only surrounded by amazing teachers, but you're also surrounded by amazing students and peers as well. So you learn from both. You learn from your entire environment. So what was your favorite module during the LLB?
It was international law with Julio Fondes, because we just spent the whole class just, you know, arguing about something.
It's interesting because I think your research is on corporate law and like takeover regulation,
yeah.
Very commercial side of things. So like,
yeah, indeed. I mean, it's strange, Andrew. And you know, I think everyone who gets to my old age and tells the story of their life and the path of their career. And I know at your age, you're thinking, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and then after that, I'm going to do A, B, and C, and that's how I'm planning out my life. But at least my experience, most people I know, it's an experience of such profound contingency, and something happens and it just takes you down a path. So I never studied corporate law at university at all.
Wow.
And I started my doctorate was an international law and legal theory doctorate. And as I transitioned in that doctorate from there to the space of corporate law. And it was just, you know, it was just following what I found really interesting. I mean, it caused some consternation for my supervisors, like, where the hell are you going here? but
why didn't you just go and work at the UN, an international organization? You know, you spend so much time, you did an entire doctorate on international law, and then suddenly you pivot towards commercial law. Do you feel like that was a waste of your time?
God no, it's absolutely fantastic and the foundation of my whole career, really. I mean, I've always been interested in different things. I've always been happy to explore a new area, a completely separate area. I've always felt confident to say, well, I don't know about that, but I can find out and work it out. And I think that experience of being quite so eclectic in the early part of my career just served me so well there. So no, I've never felt that. Although, to be honest with you, at the time I went to Harvard to do my SGD, that was part of my thinking. It was, you know, maybe I'll go and work for an international organization, maybe try and work for the UN. But, you know, lots of things happen, Andrew, in your life that, you know, the path of your life, path of your work, you know, the people you fall in love with, right? Who offer, in my case, that was also the case. I met my wife in Harvard, and she's Viennese, and had to come out to Vienna, and then we had to go to the States. So it was all a mess, but you know, it works out in the end.
That's a very interesting statement. Thank you for that answer. Just one last part about the LLB and about different modules. You said very interesting things about how you chose to do international law and you didn't do any corporate law modules, but a lot of your career has been as a commercial lawyer. So what's your advice to current law students for choosing their optional modules? Do you go with, you know, what you're really interested in? Do you go with what would be professionally useful to you in the future? How would you go about it if you were a student now?
I think it's a balance, right? You can't ignore what the you know, the pathway of your career, what's professionally interesting. You need to take account of that. But you also need to take account of your interests. I think you need to take account of your interests for two reasons. I think you will do better in those subjects that you really feel passionate about. And ultimately, that matters as much as anything. Secondly, you know, sort of, I think maybe surprisingly for some students is that, you know, even say the corporate and commercial law firms, et cetera, they're not just interested in people who've studied, you know, my courses, corporate law or takeover regulation or commercial contracts. I mean, they're interested in that, but they're not just interested in that. They're interested in people who are interesting and people who are interested in many things, because that's what they want, right? Once you get there, they want people who have inquiry minds. So I would always, always encourage students to be very open to the things that excite them and that are interested in. Of course, there's a balance. Maybe you feel like you need a set of modules, but never just choose the modules solely on the basis of what you think an employer will want. Because it's often difficult for students to predict that.
Okay, let's move to the LLM at Harvard then. So just a few quick questions. What made you pursue an LLM at Harvard? How did you even get into Harvard? I mean, how much did you pay?
Well, it was a lot easier in those days, right? And it seriously was a lot easier. Everything was easier, it seems to me, in those days. So, you know, I just applied, and I think I had a range of sort of theoretical interests at the time that I think resonated with the people who were doing the admissions, and certainly the person who became my supervisor ultimately, who was the director of the program at the time, Professor David Kennedy. So, again, I think it was about my interest. It was about my eclectic interests that I expressed in my proposal. I'd like to do this. I'd like to find out about this. I don't know much about this, but I'd really like to know about this. And I think that just resonated, right? Yeah, you know, I applied for one place and I was very fortunate to get in. It was a bit of a stupid thing to do, to be honest with you, because if you decide you want to do an American LLM, you apply for six or seven. You don't apply for one. But I got lucky.
Yeah. I mean, I think you must have been an amazing student as well to have gotten in.
I think they like the ideas, but honestly, it was easier. But yeah, I'm telling you, it was a lot easier.
So learning a different jurisdiction's laws and processes, that's quite an interesting experience. So what struck you most about that?
What struck me most about that? Well, I mean, what struck me most about doing the LLM was sort of the theoretical range of people there and their openness and willingness to talk about things that I would think, well, I would say, but I'm not X, I'm not a sociologist, I'm not an economist, you know, I'm not an accountant, you know, I'm not an English major, I can't talk about those things. And what was just amazing at Harvard was, I think partly because of the fact that legal education in the United States is a postgraduate discipline. So you had lots of students who had studied economics, had studied English, had studied psychology. So there was just this sense everywhere that people were willing to dive in, intimidating, exceptionally intimidating, as people who on the whole older than me would talk in rooms of 100, 130, 20 people about so articulately about things that I just felt I didn't understand, but their confidence to do so was amazing. So I remember just being influenced by that, which is not really a jurisdictional issue so much. You know, from a jurisdictional perspective, the things that I studied there were on the whole, you know, they were, you know, I wasn't studying US contract doctrine or US tort doctrine or trust. I did study US constitutional law, which was a pretty amazing experience. And although I have actually briefly forgotten the chap who taught it, Charles, former Solicitor General to President Reagan, and his second name just eludes me for a second, but he was astonishing. And that was amazing, right? It was what was amazing was not just learning about another jurisdiction and how that jurisdiction's law worked, although, you know, initially it's sort of relatively similar to the UK. But what was amazing at the time was how they taught law. So Charles Freed, that was his name, Professor Charles Freed, amazing. And he would teach a class of 100 people Socratically. And every day you turn up and you'd have 5 hours a week with him, and he would teach Socratically. So you would start off just like you see in, you know, in the American movies, when you would ask someone, tell me about the facts of the case. And then he would inquire and you would delve into that. And it was just amazing. I was just amazed at how teachers in a large room could just sort of pull out all the ideas as if you were in a small class with 6 or 7 people. So I've always been enamored with that. I've always thought I'd like to replicate it somehow in the UK, but it's difficult with our traditions and the amount of time that students have and the fact that it's an undergraduate legal discipline.
You know, nowadays there's this paper chase for, you know, the bachelor's degree, a master's degree, a doctorate. So how useful do you think a master's degree is for a career in commercial law? Do you advise people to just go straight into becoming a lawyer, or do you advise them to, you know, take some time in the academic field?
Well, sometimes it's always a question of whether, as you put it before, whether you're broke, right, Andrew, because it costs a lot of money and scholarships and, you know, few and far between. But if you can find the money or you do get a scholarship, then 100% I would encourage people to do a master's degree. And 100% I would encourage them to go to a different country, like the United States. It's this amazing cultural experience. It's an amazing educational experience to learn about how people do things differently. And you guys are young, right? I mean, how old are you, Andrew, if I can ask?
Well, I'm 22 this year.
Oh, actually. You're a young, young man, right? You've got lots of time on your hands. Although, of course, you all feel like it's like, oh, I've got to be quick. I've got to hurry up. I've got to do this. I've got to, you know, make my first million by the time I'm 28, whatever it may be. And I would say, no, don't do that. You know, if you can afford it and take the time. And going to the question, you said, well, do you need it for being a commercial lawyer? And the answer is no, you don't. And I think many law firms would give you the opposite advice that I'm giving you, would say, come on in, we'll teach you what you need to know and you can make some good money. And I get that. And it can be incredibly rewarding, but to take an extra year just to do something that you find fascinating and interesting, whether or not it's commercial law or corporate law, whatever it may be, I just think it's utterly invaluable. It's just the most fun, and you know, life is short, so take that extra year. That would always be my advice if you're fortunate enough to be able to afford it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to your qualification experience at Herbert Smith in London. So why did you decide to come back to the UK? You already had a foothold in the US. Why didn't you just want to explore some firms within the US as well?
Great question. I'm not sure I have a very good answer to it, really. I think I was pretty homesick, actually. I was still relatively young, 21, and I didn't feel like I was ready to sort of just put my roots down in the United States. Didn't know really what I wanted to do, so applied for jobs at Herbert Smith, at Freshfields, at Linklaters. I got offers from all of them, and decided to go to HS, Herbert Smith Freehills, now Herbert Smith at the time, and came back and did what at the time was called Law Society Finals, which was the LPC, which I did in York. And yeah, so it was, again, sort of a decision that not necessarily, you know, sometimes I'm sure you know what it's like, Andrew. It's like, well, what am I going to do? Well, you know, you'll be there soon. You'll be thinking about, well, you know, what pathway am I going to take? Am I going to a corporate law firm, or am I going to go into a different type of law firm, or am I going to go into the bar? You know, how do we make those decisions? It's really hard, right?
Yeah.
There's so many factors that go into them, and sometimes you just got to say, well, I don't know, I'll do that. And so I think that was quite a lot of, I don't know, I'll do that at the time.
Yeah. Why did you decide to become a solicitor and not a barrister? Especially, I think you seem to be able to speak or articulate your ideas really well, and you're very handsome and charming as well.
Oh, yes.
So why did you not decide to become a barrister?
Well, I almost did. And I often afterwards wished I had, although I, you know, obviously don't regret any of the pathway that I subsequently took. But I did apply for many pupillages. I went to talk to some barristers' chambers, but things were quite different in those days. So my background, Andrew, is I'm a northern lad, originally born in Clitheroe in Lancashire, and then my parents moved to the what we call the posh part of the north in Harrogate, which is in Yorkshire. Went to a state school and was the first person of my generation to go to university. So it did really well at Warwick. But then I went to some interviews, and I remember a couple, and there was one person in there. There were 10, you know, what seemed to me to be quite posh people sitting around in a room. And I just was so utterly intimidated, and just felt at the time that I'm sure many other people for many other reasons still feel today, and certainly felt then. I just felt like I just don't belong here. This is not a place where I am. This is not me. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. And I think that was a real mistake. One of the, you know, big mistake, actually. I mean, things, you know, turned out great in the end, but it was a mistake because the right response should have been, you know, sod that. If I actually, you know, I can do this. I might not feel comfortable, but they're nice people. And they were nice people. And it's like, you know, I'll just do it. And so that was a mistake. And I feel like I did learn from that mistake. You know, when I've encountered similar situations after that, it's like, no, I'm not going to, you know, I might not feel comfortable, but, you know, come on, let's do this. And so that's why I didn't go to the bar ultimately, but not a very good reason.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people had very similar reasons in the past and even now as well. But I've been reading reports about how, you know, the bar is trying to increase access to that field.
And I think they have. And I think it's profoundly different today and profoundly more open to different people from different backgrounds. It really is. It's just a different phenomenon. But this, Andrew, is a long time ago, right? We're talking about, I think it was 1991.
Yeah. So what drew you to Herbert Smith in London? From you said that you had a lot of offers.
Well, I had this idea in my head that I wanted to do litigation. I thought that would be, you know, really interesting. I've always liked legal argument, building arguments. You know, I'd love that. That's why I love teaching, right? I love my corporate law class to undergraduates and postgraduates. It's on the one hand about learning about corporate law, but it's also about learning how to build arguments from often very, you know, materials that you have to construct and pull together to strengthen your argument. And so I thought that's what litigation would be about, which is why I was originally drawn to the bar. But that I didn't feel like I fit there for the wrong reasons that I gave before. So I thought going to a big litigation firm, which Herbert Smith is, would be the way to go. As it turned out, I think that was a poor choice. And not because Herbert Smith isn't a great firm, it is, but I just didn't really realize that so much of that work would be, you know, it is about arguments, but the building the argument part is quite a small part of managing so much else in the court process.
There's a lot of paper pushing, right?
There's a lot of managing documents at a junior level. It was interesting, but yeah, huge amount of managing process and managing documents at a junior level. I didn't enjoy that as much. Later in my career, I became an M&A lawyer, and I enjoyed that an awful lot more, even though that's not really about building arguments, right? That's about swift, quick moving and negotiation and writing documents, yeah, rather than actually just organizing them. So that was the reason I went there. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I just did it for 2 years. After 2 years, I was pretty convinced that it wasn't for me. So I left.
And then you went to do your SJD at Harvard. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got on the SJD program. So I'd done 2 years. And I really, as I said, I really enjoyed Herbert Smith. I worked with some brilliant people, really brilliant people, and made some really great, great, great mates there.
What was the favorite case or the most memorable case that you did at Herbert Smith?
I was involved in big litigation in relation to a failed management buyout from the kitchen firm, which is still around today, I think, called Magnet. And then involved in huge, absolutely massive litigation in relation to BCCI, the collapse of BCCI, which is a huge bank. So those are the big things I was involved in. The smaller things tended to be, for a young associate, the most interesting. The most interesting were when something was starting, you know, a client comes in and says, I think I've got a problem. I'd like to do this. What can we do? And then you get sent off to do a memo on the arguments that you might build in this case, the things that might be relevant. And that was the fun stuff. That was what I really enjoyed. The big stuff, you know, you're a very small cog in a very, very big wheel, which is great fun working with people. There's a real sense of camaraderie, working together and making progress. But the sort of intellectually interesting stuff was always the small stuff. So I really enjoyed that.
I see. Okay. Let's move on to your time as an M&A lawyer in Sherman and Sterling. So initially you were in New York and then you came back to London at the same firm, right?
Right.
So what was your experience like in this firm?
Well, I loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved it. I mean, I think, you know, Andrew, you know, in a couple of years' time, you know, hopefully when you've done your master's and then you'll be looking to go into, you know, a big firm.
So I need to find a wife from Vienna.
Yeah. Well, okay. But once you've, once you know where you're going, when you enter that job, it's that first job's pretty difficult. I mean, you're a little bit older than I was when you'd be going into that first job. So I think that really helps, right? I was quite immature, I think. So when I started at Herbert Smith, I just didn't have the right attitude to work. I just didn't. It was like, oh, got to go to work. You know, I really like studying, got to go to work. It's really the wrong attitude, which meant that I didn't get enough from it, out of it. I really didn't. But when I went to Sherman Sterling, it was like, yeah, okay, this is second chance, second time. We're going to, you know, it's going to be great. And I went in there with a really good attitude and it was a brilliant place to work. It was amazing that Sherman Sterling took me on. They took me on as a third year associate. I've never done M&A before. I didn't do a corporate seat in Herbert Smith. And as a third year associate, you actually have quite a lot of responsibility in a US law firm, right? So you're already getting basic deals, you're drafting transaction documents. Sometimes you're leading on deals. And I got staffed on a couple of deals where the people above me were just so busy that they just didn't have any time for what was actually a pretty substantial deal. And that was fantastic. So it meant that it was mine. And, you know, it was pretty frightening because you really were in control and you'd have, this was a big restructuring deal. And so you'd have the CEO and the legal counsel asking you big questions. And some of the time you wouldn't know the answer to them. And it's a bit difficult. You know, on the one hand, you clearly can't tell someone something where you don't know the answer. On the other hand, you don't want to give them the impression that you don't know what you're talking about, right? So it was difficult, but it was phenomenal. It was hard work. You know, working in a US law firm is a serious amount of work. But my wife and I, being in New York, being in these firms, she was working. She's also an M&A lawyer, and she was working at Debevoise in Plimpton.
Oh.
You know, we had an awesome time. It was great. But I guess we always knew that that at some point in time, I wanted to go into what I do now. And my wife was happy with that. The question we had to decide on where we were going to be, whether that was going to be in the States or in the UK.
That's so interesting. I think you guys are a power couple, actually.
Definitely not.
M&A couple.
We were definitely an M&A couple at the time. That's for sure.
Honestly, this is a slight digression, but I think it's also useful for aspiring lawyers to think about this as well. Like, how did you manage your relationship during that time? I'm sure that two people in M&A law in the US, that must have been quite an experience trying to juggle between your work life and your relationship.
Well, it didn't feel too bad, to be honest with you, Andrew. We didn't have kids at the time. If we'd have had kids, obviously it would have been a lot harder, but we were relatively young. We were I was in my early 30s. My wife was in her late 20s. You know, we worked hard. She was perhaps less forgiving of me working hard than I was of her. I guess I always had the view that if they were paying you so much money, well, you'd kind of like, you know, you'd sold your soul. If they wanted you to work the weekend, then, you know, you're going to work the weekend. But she would always find that difficult. If I had to work the weekend and she was free, it was like, you know, why are you working the weekend? So, well, they're paying me a lot of money. I said, well, I know that, but why are you working the weekend? So, but, you know, yeah, we know we loved it. We had an absolutely brilliant time, as you can imagine, right? We had a fair bit of cash. We were exploring and getting to know New York. And we, you know, we both enjoyed doing what we were doing because I think we had this, we finally discovered a super attitude to it instead of moaning about what we were doing. We just said, yeah, this is going to be good. And it was.
What's your one piece of advice for future professional couples trying to balance their work and their life? Did you have certain structures in place? So like one date a week?
No, I mean, we were sort of a little bit fortunate in a way. I suppose we were fortunate because we arrived just after the dot-com boom burst. I mean, we had a lot of work. I mean, we were probably billing 2,200, 2,500 hours a year, but it's not like what some people are doing today, which is 3,000 to 3,500 hours, right? So it was good. You know, one piece of advice, the only piece of advice is that you haven't got a lot of time on your hands. So the time that you have, you need to spend with each other, right? Unfortunately, if you're going to make a trade-off, it's going to be everyone else, and you're going to make sure that you spend time with each other. So, and there are always times, right? In any job, right? There's always going to be, it's going to be pretty rare that you can't get Friday and Saturday nights.
Okay, thank you. I'll take that advice. But first, I need to find a girl first.
Yeah, well, I can give you the advice. I can't help you with that. So.
All right. So what was your most memorable case? And this attraction to M&A, right? Did you have a specific economic area as a focus? For instance, like commodities or TMT?
No. Shilmacillion I don't know whether they do today, but they didn't divide things up at all in that way. So, you'd be in a pretty large group. And you just get staffed. You'd get staffed on private deals, on public deals. You just get a call. I mean, you were always a little bit frightened of Friday afternoons. All the associates were frightened of Friday afternoons because you looked like your weekend was looking good, and you could suddenly get a last minute call that could completely destroy it. But which it often did. But no, I mean, I guess the most memorable case was that one, which was a huge deal for me. It was the sale of two companies that had largely failed, in part connected to the dot-com boom, but not directly. So it was a company called GlobeNet that had an underwater cable system between the US and Brazil, and a connected subsidiary company called TeleBermuda. So, they were both connected, but we had to sell them separately in two auctions. This is a pretty massive process because, these companies had failed, and it took a long time. So that's if you get staffed on a deal like that, a large section of your time, for a couple of years could be doing that, right? Most deals are not like that. Most deals have, they have a period of time within which they have to happen, and they happen and we move on. But this one lasted for a long time.
I see. You were at Sherman & Sterling in New York at around 2001, 2002. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right.
So that was around the time of the Enron scandal as well. Were you at all involved in the legal process of that?
No. I remember when it hit, and Enron for me was a huge thing in terms of my own career. I published two articles on the effects of Enron on accounting regulation. So it was a big deal for me personally, but I remember when it happened. So, and no, I mean, none of us were, very few of us were directly involved, but I remember a chap called David Helinak. I think that's how you pronounce his name, who was the senior partner at Sherman Sterling at the time, who interestingly, the Moot courtroom is named after him, right? It's the Moot courtroom on the seventh floor. It's the Helinak, I think it is. He was the senior partner at Sherman Sterling at the time. And, I remember when it all hit, when WorldCom and Enron, and then there was the conversation about the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in the United States, which imposes additional obligations upon auditors and additional obligations upon the chief executive officers of companies in relation to their accounts and their internal controls. And I remember he stood up in a room in Sherman Sterling on Lexington Avenue and I think 51st. And he said, you guys need to remember this because this is a major moment. You will remember this. This act that's coming through now will have such profound effects upon corporate governance in the United States and globally. You guys should remember this and pay attention. And, to a large extent, he was right. That's what I remember at that time.
I think that's the really interesting thing about working in New York as opposed to other jurisdictions is that you're right at the center of financial crime.
Yeah. Well, I think, working in a US law firm, working in a UK law firm, you are, in London, from the corporate, financial perspective, you are at the heart of the action, whether it's be corporate scandal, whether it be M&A, IPOs, private equity work. I mean, it's very similar today in terms of how close you are to the beating heart of everything. You struggle to find better places, I think, to work as a corporate lawyer than those two jurisdictions.
I see. So what are the differences between working in New York as a corporate lawyer and working in London as a corporate lawyer?
Well, it's tough to say that now, Andrew, really, because I've been out of the action for such a long time, right? So I left corporate legal practice in 2003. I wasn't in it for such a long period of time. What were the differences I can talk to then? But they may not be the case now. I mean, one of the things that I guess two differences I could refer to. The first one is that it always felt like the US lawyers, and people say this, were more business orientated than UK lawyers. And I think in some ways that just sort of reflects the confidence of US lawyers compared to UK lawyers, which I think in some ways is reflected in law being a postgraduate discipline in the United States. And, you know, I mentioned before in Harvard, I was just being amazed at those students who would be so articulate in a room of 120 people without nerves. And it was always just incredible. And I think that sort of confidence flows through into the law office. And so one thing that I was always struck with by and tried to emulate when I was at Shulman Sterling was these lawyers that would never think there was anything that was off limits for them to have an opinion on. So, you know, if you were talking about, you know, business risk and business choices, they would pipe up and their views were really, really well received. Whereas my experience at the time was that UK lawyers would be more hesitant to do that. And they would stick to their brief, if you like, their legal brief. Now that could have profoundly changed since then. And the other thing that was of note, and it's always quite funny this one, having worked on both sides of the fence, is that you know, both lawyers would always complain about the drafting style of the other lawyers. The US lawyers would always say, you know, UK drafting style is too loose and leaves too much open. And the UK lawyers would always say, oh my God, those US lawyers go on and on and on in their agreements. It's unbearable. They're so long. So you know, it was kind of funny to be on both sides of the fence. And it's what's always really interesting, Andrew, is when you're on both sides of the fence, how you can, you know, very quickly can just get, you can quickly adapt to wherever you are. And so when I was in the US, I shared those views. It's like, you know, these UK agreements are just not tight enough. You know, they're not covering all the bases. There's many more risks out there that they're not addressing. And then when I got to the UK, it was like, oh yeah, they do, those agreements do go on a bit, right? So those are the two key things I remember.
What were some of the push and pull factors that contributed to your decision to move back into academia?
By that time, Andrew, it never really felt like a decision. It was just something I knew I wanted to do, right? So I wanted to practice. I also wanted to earn a few quid to buy a house. And, you know, my wife wanted to go back and practice in the States. So it's like, okay, let's do that. But it was always for me personally going to be a question of when I went back into being an academic, because, you know, finally coming out of my doctorate, it was, this is what I want to do. This is what I enjoy most of all. So it was always just then a question of time and a question of when I was happy to take the pay cut. And, you know, obviously talking together with my wife, or when she was happy for me to take the pay cut, you know, we made that decision in 2003. I started looking for a job in 2003. We decided it would be in the UK rather than the US. And I guess, you know, that was kind of like, I'd been away from the UK for 7 years and from Europe. And I think we both felt ultimately that Europe was our center of gravity, and that's where our family is. So we thought we'd come back. And I started looking for a job. And then I fortunately landed my first job at the University of Warwick.
Where it all started.
Where it started for me. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. I think we're coming to the end of our interview, but just a few questions about sure. You know, advice for current and prospective LSE law students. So what would be your one piece of advice, knowing what you know now?
But one piece of advice, knowing what I know now.
Well, two pieces of advice.
Okay. I know this is so difficult. It's just so easy to say, but try not to get too over-focused upon what comes after this. This is a truly amazing experience, right? You've got an incredible intellectual experience. You've got wonderful people around you. We now have this amazing campus that you can enjoy. You know, don't spoil that by just over-focusing and obsessing about what comes next in the form of your next job, etc. You know, you've got here, it's amazing what you've achieved getting here, it really is. And I know this talk is cheap, but just enjoy it. Learn, enjoy that intellectual engagement, enjoy learning, enjoy finding out, enjoy meeting people, spending time with friends. So that's number one, right? You know, it will come. And I know sometimes it's stressful, you're looking for the next job, you're worried about that, you know, you're looking for your job, you're worried about that job, you're worried perhaps about your financial position going forward. I know all those are real things that you have to worry about and take account of, but I do feel that sometimes our students get that balance slightly wrong and that they become over-focused upon that. So I would love it if they didn't do that. And secondly, the other thing I guess I would say is, and it's connected to what I said before when I talked about working with my two best buddies at the time and still my best buddies today, Richard Moorhead and Matt Cowie. And you remember this, I talked about you this about the beginning of the year, right? I sometimes think our students are, partly because they're worried about what comes next, is that they don't always, you know, cooperate in ways that can enhance everything they do as well, right? So, you know, and you know, learn how to work together, enjoy working together, learn, teach each other. And I think you'll have a brilliant time, right, doing that, but B, you'll also do better. So I guess that would be the second piece of advice.
Thank you for sharing.
Very welcome.
And I guess the last question is, you know, happy Valentine's Day. So do you have any plans for tonight?
I do not. I have to confess, Valentine's Day is not a day that we've always sort of celebrated. Every day is Valentine's Day with me, Andrew. God says. So no major plans, apart from I'm at home today. So making sure that my kids have done their homework. So but that's about it. So,
that's good. You got to share.
Maybe there should be. I'll tell my wife that you're concerned about that and that we should be doing something.
Yeah, you should get her some roses. But actually just helping out in the housework is already amazing.
Well, don't worry. I do lots of that. So.
Okay, but thank you so much for being on the show as well. For our inaugural episode, I think that there was no one better than, our own Dean to come on board.
You're very welcome, Andrew. And I once again just say thanks for doing this. This is, I think, such an awesome project. I hope you get lots of people who want to support it and get involved with it. It's just brilliant. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSCs on the Case. See you next time!